The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Coo-coo-ca-choo, everybody, and many thanks for checking out the Top 100 Project, the podcast that takes a look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 list of the 100 greatest American movies. Spoiler alert, Mrs. Robinson, we're going to analyze this flick from its nose to its toes. I am Ryan Ellis with my bus-riding, wedding-dress-wearing wife, Bev.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia for this week's film, The Graduate. Mike Nichols took home the Oscar for Best Director, which was the sole Academy Award The Graduate won. What's the only other AFI movie for which its sole Oscar was for Best Director?
I really have no idea. I thought about it. I have no idea.
We covered it. It also starts with a G.
Oh, Gone with the Wind?
No.
No.
Much more recent than that. Not one of your favorites. Giant. George Stevens won for that film, the only Oscar.
Yikes.
On many nominations. This one had several, but not as many as Giant. Okay, then, enough about that. The Top 100 Project's 73rd picture, The Graduate, was a lofty 7th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between The Wizard of Oz and On the Waterfront. Then it dropped out of the top 10 and ranked 17th in 2007 between Buster Keaton's two AFI appearances, Sunset Boulevard and The General. Embassy Pictures and United Artists shot The Graduate out into the world on December 22nd, 1967, a little Christmas release. Big Christmas release, actually. Crowds loved it, and the film earned so very much money. And Belle will tell you about that money-making film with The Skinny.
Dustin Hoffman is Benjamin Braddock, a mopey college graduate living in Los Angeles with no job and no direction. And Bancroft is Mrs. Robinson, a friend of his parents who seduces the awkward Ben. Conflict! Mrs. Robinson's daughter Elaine, played by Catherine Ross, catches Ben's eye and his heart, too.
Or in a nutshell, newlywed and her stalker's enthusiasm about public transportation quickly fades. One of the most famous endings in any movie ever. Absolutely. Certainly on the AFI list. And even if you haven't seen the movie, you have to know this ending.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a spoiler right off the bat as they take off on the bus. All right, well, The Graduate. This is one of the most famous titles in the entire list. And as I said, 7th and 17th, which are remarkably impressive rankings. What'd you think of it?
I like it. But I really take issue with it being called one of the greatest films of all time.
I'm with you 100%.
And, yeah. Keep going. Keep talking. Yeah, okay. It has one of the most clever and adeptly directed scenes in cinema history. It's fun as hell to watch and sink your teeth into the technique. As a film study, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Every scene you could analyze, every decision that they made, it's so well done. However, as a whole, it's always left me cold. Has a few flaws that, in my opinion, should have kept it from the tippy top of this list. And maybe it's still enjoying some goodwill left over from people who were so blown away by the freshness of it back in 67.
Yeah, because it's dated, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Many people have pointed this out, even some reputable critics like Roger Ebert. He comes up yet again. He did not rave about it in his second review in the mid-90s when they re-released it, nor did Gene Siskel. In fact, on their show, they both said, as I recall, mild thumbs down, or if they said thumbs up, it was not nearly as enthusiastic as you might expect for a movie that's this famous and popular.
When he first saw it in 67, he wrote an absolute rave review.
Mm, four-star review. Yeah. The funniest American comedy of the year.
Yeah, and you read, his second review is great. It's like a great kind of explanation of what it's like when a film ages and what it's like when you age out of a film's audience. You know, he loved it so much in 67, but he said it was in the 80s, the 30th anniversary? No.
The 90s. 97, I believe. I think it was. When they also re-released The Godfather and the Star Wars movies.
Because it was the 30th anniversary of The Graduate, right? And he says at that age, he related to Mrs. Robinson so much more than Benjamin. And actually, Benjamin is a fundamentally bad character. Like, he's an unlikable character. Yep. He isn't redeemable. He's kind of a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not relating to him in any way, it's kind of hard to follow him through the film and understand why you're supposed to care if he winds up with Elaine. You kind of instead want Elaine to get away from him. He's a creep.
And Ebert points it out very adeptly in his review. I feel the same way. I don't think I needed someone to tell me that, especially when we see at this time, here I am 40 years old, you're in your mid-30s. As Ebert again points out in his review, he gets the ranking babe in the neighborhood who wants him. Now, here's a bit of a question for you. Do you think that she wanted him for a long time, or does she just pick this out of the midair when he comes home and she sees him at that party? I'm going to seduce that guy.
We never really learn her story and why she's doing it specifically with Benjamin, but I think in my imagination, she picks him specifically to get back at her husband. It's her husband's business partner's son.
Yeah.
So it's the worst person she could possibly have an affair with. It's somebody half her age who's got his whole life ahead of him. You know, they can't stop reminding him that he has this bright future. There's nobody that could hurt her husband more except maybe Benjamin's father, but for whatever reason,
she... He could be like Elaine's cousin. They're not that close. It couldn't be her brother, but because they would have grown up together in some sort of way. In a manner of speaking, it could be her relative.
It's a little strange that they treat them as if they're strangers. Though the parents may have spent time together, they didn't mingle the kids as much.
That could be, but one of the most important scenes in the whole movie, and we didn't get why Ben didn't get it, when Elaine comes up, when they're in the hotel room after they've been doing this for weeks. And by the way, the sex must be pretty good because they keep going back there.
Yeah.
They must both like it, even if they don't seem to actually like anything else in their lives. Either of them. Neither of them seems to really enjoy themselves.
No, they're both very unhappy.
In anything. Sex or anything else. We don't see the actual sex, really. But when Elaine's name comes up in that one scene, he had never thought about trying to seduce her. And then he has to have it explained to him, why can't I go out and date your daughter? I'm not good enough. Where is that coming from? And she should just say what we said to each other, which is, no, because you've been banging me. I don't want you banging my daughter, too. Or maybe even taking it further than just banging.
It's so ridiculous that he even needs an explanation for why she wouldn't want him to go out with her daughter. Because you guys are sleeping together, you total weirdo.
And why does he actually go after her, meaning Elaine? Probably because Mrs. Robinson, we never find out her first name. What famous character not that long ago in another great movie was the same thing? A character, we never find out her first name, but she's a key part of the movie.
Oh, I was going to say Dr. Strangelove, but you just said it's a her.
Mrs. Iceland in Manchurian Candidate.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Another evil matriarch. Much less sympathetic
this one's
than
not
Mrs. Robinson.
Evil. Let's get bankrupt in a second, but that scene. So then Ben probably goes out with her just to spite Mrs. Robinson, although he's also coerced into it by his parents.
Yeah, he's pretty heavily cajoled by his parents.
But he also seems like he wants to do it. He may be denying to Mrs. Robinson, who then, at that point, the sexual relationship is over, and you can tell that she's got her knives out for him, and you really, in some ways, can't blame her. So he does it for that reason. But again, I'll reference Ebert, who points out he's also doing exactly what his parents wanted him to do in the first place, which is take out Elaine. So Mr. Rage Against the Machine, maybe he's not trying to be that, but that's what people have pointed him out in this movie, is what he represents to them, young people back in 67. Those who see it now, who are that age, might feel the same way. He's my counterculture icon. And we said before, Bonnie and Clyde, Graduate, Easy Rider are the three red-letter movies of this era that are the counterculture movies. There are many others, but those three in particular. But he's doing exactly what the parents he doesn't even relate to want him to do.
Yeah, and initially they want nothing more than for Ben and Elaine to end up together, which is what happens at the end of the film, and what nobody wants by the end of the film is for Ben and Elaine to wind up together. So it's kind of like an interesting little switcheroo. This is the point also where the film goes from being promising and entertaining
and
fun.
Funny.
Yeah, and funny, and you can kind of forgive any missteps it makes or kind of confusing inconsistencies in the characters because you're enjoying the film so much and it's taking you to this great place and you want to see where it goes. But that's where it just turns on a dime. As soon as Elaine is introduced as a character, for me, it fell apart completely.
Completely. I wouldn't go quite as far as completely, but I would go as far as to say it falls apart to a point.
Yeah, I still really love the ending. I think that final shot is hyped for a reason. It is an incredible moment in cinema in general. But that whole act of them falling in love
isn't believable, for one thing.
It's so absurd.
Mike Nichols, we said it already, he won the Oscar for Best Director. What exactly does the director do? He or she is the person in charge of the entire film. That's such a broad thing to say. But one of the biggest things the director has to do, or two of them, I guess, is where do you put the camera and can you maintain the right tone? I said to you recently that I heard M. Night Shyamalan say that about The Godfather, one of the reasons he loves that movie. Shyamalan's opinion, I know he's not exactly Mr. Beloved anymore, although he does have an AFI film, The Sixth Sense, one of our last ones. I think he made a good point, and I agree with him, that that's such a key thing. And Nichols does direct the film, technically, even better than I ever remembered it. I hadn't seen it in quite a while. The long takes, which he also had in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The great camera angles, including the most famous one, would be the poster shot with the crooked leg and Benjamin in the distance. He set several conversations where we can't hear them or see them. Not both. Either you hear and it's dark, or you see what they're saying. But like at the end, when they're all yelling at him, when he's trying to, Elaine, Elaine, trying to stop the wedding. Although it's, there you go. That's one of the smart things about this movie. She does get married.
Yeah.
But you don't hear what the parents and everyone downstairs is saying, probably swearing at him. So Nichols has a problem with tone because the movie's really funny. Is it one of the funniest movies of all time? That's debatable. But it is pretty funny. And the second half, here and there is. Otherwise, no. Is that a deliberate choice?
If it's a deliberate choice, in my opinion, it was the wrong choice to change Ben's character so drastically, to fail to give Elaine any real motivations or character.
I agree with you, but you had real problems with her, and you said so when we took a 5-minute break during the movie.
Her motivations are nonsense. She forgives Ben for taking her to his strip club as soon as he explains that he was cajoled into taking her out, but why is that even an excuse for being so mean to her? And then they hit it off, but she finds out about her mother, and then she just thinks he's a stalker who raped her mother. So she goes to his apartment, where she's alone with him in his room to confront him. It's the most insane, irrational thing. No human would do that. But then she immediately takes his word for it when he says her mother's lying. She has no personality to speak of, except that she's also annoyed by her parents, and she's a very skilled applicator of false eyelashes. I just think she's hopelessly poorly conceived, and it's a really frustrating part of the film. I think it ruins the second half of the film.
And Catherine Ross, you just said the eyelash thing. I think she's very beautiful.
She's a very pretty girl.
But she doesn't have much else in this movie to do but be pretty and be remarkably inconsistent. We're going to see her in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid not long from now, several weeks away, her other AFI film. She's only in those two. She was also in The Stepford Wives in the mid-70s, and then she's got a role in Donnie Darko. She's Donnie's doctor in that film. But apart from being sweet and pretty, she's blank and, as we said, so fickle. She gets more to do in Butch Cassidy, at least, as the third lead. She's a Sundance Kid's girlfriend. Maybe that's not a great role either, but this one is nonsensical is a good word for it. Why does she even want Ben?
Why does he want her? They are the two most charmless characters that have nothing to offer one another except rebellion.
Yeah, I suppose so. He says at one point on their date, when he takes her to that strip club, and interestingly, we're going to see the same kind of thing in Taxi Driver, where a guy is sabotaging something. Travis is not doing it on purpose, but something inside of him is, to corrupt Betsy, Sybil Shepherd's character. And in this movie, Ben is doing it on purpose, so he drives Elaine away, but then soon after apologizes when he sees her crying. I like that moment, actually. That's one of Catherine Ross's best moments, where she's sitting and the girl with the very large knockers and the tassels on them is swinging the tassels right above her head. And Elaine's mind, she's being humiliated. And the crying scene, I thought that was really well played.
I don't like that scene, because why wouldn't she just get up, leave, call a cab, call her parents, right? Ask them to pick her up?
Yeah.
Why would she even have put up with it to this point? If I were her, in that time and place, the second I walked into a strip club, enough is enough. You've been rude to me this whole time. You're driving like a maniac. You clearly don't want to be here.
Yeah.
I don't feel safe. Who would feel safe with
Betsy him? Does that. And Taxi Driver, she bails before the movie even really gets going. Doesn't hang around for the entire 2-hour film.
No, why would you? Why would Elaine stay and sit there and stare at him with big doe eyes and cry? Get out of there.
Let me give you the Hitchcock answer, because there would be no movie.
You know, that answer is fair, but it's also
sometimes
a crutch.
No, it's not fair, actually.
Crutch.
Yeah, it's a crutch. It's always a crutch.
Yeah.
And in this case, it may be even more so. The thing that Ben should have done was just be himself. Because as we said in the beginning, he's a mopey loser. In a lot of ways, he's a loser. Despite the fact that people want to latch on to him as being this counterculture icon. But he is played by one of my favorite actors of all time in his big breakout role, and one that he wasn't even supposed to have. Robert Redford was in line for it at one point. I'm not so sure he almost had it, I'm not saying that. But Mike Nichols, when he was auditioning all the people, and Redford could have been Nick in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
He would have been great as Nick, but I can see why he shouldn't have been cast
because as Benjamin. The question that Nichols had for him is, how did you react when you struck out with a girl? What do you mean? Exactly. You don't know what it's like to be a loser. Because anybody would want Robert Redford, especially at that age. He was an absolute god. And we're going to see him in a few weeks in Butch Cassidy.
At any age, people. I saw All Is Lost. He's still a very handsome man.
Right. So Anne Bancroft going after him makes perfect sense. In this movie, she goes after a guy who it doesn't make sense. And interestingly, those two will work together in All the President's Men, where they're also very different kinds of characters. And they had some conflicts in that film, but it was productive. They made a great picture that didn't make the first list, made the second list. But back to Hoffman, his very first AFI film, he's in 4 in total. Midnight Cowboys, not that long from now, one of the 4 we're going to see in 1969. All the President's Men, like I said, and Tootsie. All 4 very diverse roles, so different. He always seems to be able to lose himself in roles, more so than other actors I love. Hackman and Nicholson and many of the other greats, I could go on a whole list here, that don't really seem to change all that much in their movies. And they don't have to, but he does it as well as anybody. His awkward screen test for this movie, where he bungled lines, he made moves on Catherine Ross, that's pretty much what got him the role. And the scene where he grabs Anne Bancroft's boob was him doing a thing where when you put a girl's coat on in high school and you, oh, I didn't mean to brush against your breast. Yeah, in this case, she takes up the sweater and he instantly grabs it, and it's so awkward, and it's funny. We're still in the funny stage of the movie at that point. He was supposed to be in The Producers, the Mel Brooks movie, but he dropped out to do this flick, and Mel Brooks thought he would never get the part, so he let him audition, and Anne Bancroft was Mel Brooks' wife. Look at all the links we got going here.
Oh my gosh.
One of the best things in the whole movie that Hoffman brings to it, I don't know if it's improvised, but it's a great touch, are the whimpers that he's doing, nice pathetic touch early on. Like a little puppy, or he's literally like a 7-year-old that doesn't know what he's doing with the greatest toy he could possibly get. Not to trivialize a grown woman.
Yeah, that's like one of the most blatant comic touches in the movie. Mm-hmm. It's definitely cute, but it also gives you the impression that the movie's going to get sillier and sillier. And
rather than getting dead serious.
Yeah, yeah. And then when the tone shift happens. But wasn't this the movie that inserted all these silly whimpers just for the sake of laughing that were unrealistic but fun, very cute?
I love the smoke kiss. She takes a drag and a cigarette. He just kisses both of the women. And maybe Dustin Hoffman was doing it for this movie, or maybe Dustin Hoffman is just a bad kisser, but he looks like he doesn't know what he's doing. He just basically stops and puts his lips up against theirs, and that's it. And as soon as he pulls away from Mrs. Robinson, she blows the smoke out. Also with her eyes wide open the whole time.
Yeah. Well, she calls it that he's inexperienced.
Mm.
I took it to be true, but it's also the thing that gets him to go through with it. She's kind of challenging him, challenging his manhood in order to prove that he isn't a virgin. He has to go through with having sex with her.
Mm-hmm. One of the other funny moments in those scenes in the hotel rooms is right after he does the boob grab and he goes back and he bangs his head against the wall. The famous story about that is Nichols started laughing and Hoffman, to keep from laughing, went there and banged his head. Maybe this was in auditions. But then they kept that in and it works really well too.
Benjamin's so emo.
He's one of the uncoolest Lotharios in the history of movies, though, for sure. Even when he's finally got her, like, I understand to a certain extent the way he is in the very beginning when she first comes onto him. Let me out. That's an Hoffman voice sometimes works so well because it's such a, at times, can be such an awful voice. And by the way, if you hear rain in the background, we did a podcast not long ago where there was rain through a big chunk of the middle of it, and we have it again tonight. So if you hear some pitter-patter, that's what's going on. But I guess the whole point of this, in the early going of why it's funny, Anne Bancroft's in the AFI special, and she's the one that says, for the first time somebody was making fun of sex, it's the hilarity of seduction.
That's a really good point, because that's something that's just one of those topics everybody's afraid of. And we should mention now, this is the first film we've done that has nudity, not counting mm-hmm. the blurred nipple in Intolerance.
And Psycho, we see the model. It's not Janet Leigh, but the model in the
show. Oh, yeah, that's right. But this is some very intentional nudity. It's incredibly brief. It's probably
not Anne Bancroft.
Oh, is that right?
I don't think it's... Well, if you recognize that they cut away, if you're going to show her, you just might as well show her whole body. So it had to have been a model that was...
That's a good point.
I like that touch as well, when you do see, as much as you do, that she's got that harsh tan line thing going on.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice touch.
Whenever you see somebody who doesn't have the all-over tan, it just seems strange.
Maybe they were just trying to conjure that this was a woman of leisure whose husband was wealthy and who probably spent days on end sitting out by the pool in a bikini.
Smoking and drinking all the time.
Yeah, she was very bored and unhappy, and I guess that's how she spent her time. But they aren't shy in the film about reminding you constantly how wealthy these people are.
All of them
live in massive mansions. They buy their 21-year-old graduate son in Alfa Romeo. Mm-hmm. They throw money around like it's nothing.
And when he goes to stalk Elaine, he seems to have unlimited resources. He doesn't have a job.
Yeah,
it must be money he took, or he's wiring his parents back. I need more. Wait, I need more. And hey, I love the guy. He put that voice on for this character as much as he did, I think. Whole different voice that he has in the next movie he's going to be in, Midnight Cowboy, the Ratso Rizzo character. So Anne Bancroft, here's a trivia question for you. Who gets top billing in this film? I'm giving away the trivia question by putting it this way. She gets top billing because she was by far the bigger star.
And she's only in half the movie, really.
Mm-hmm. She's more of a supporting character, but she is nominated for Best Actress, as Hoffman was for Best Actor. So this is her only AFI performance. She was also in The Miracle Worker, the Arthur Penn movie. We covered him recently when we did Bonnie and Clyde. She was in The Elephant Man, nice small role, but a very pivotal one. And she was one of the voice actors in Ants. She did many other performances, but I like that diversity of those four movies, including The Graduate right there. She was only 6 years older than Hoffman and only 8 years older than Catherine Ross. And she doesn't look like she's a lot older. A, that's sort of the, again, we talk about Mrs. Iceland, where she plays the mother to an actor who's not that much younger than her in reality, but Angela Lansbury looked quite a bit older than Laurence Harvey, and in this movie, it kind of makes sense that she's not that much older because she is the trophy bride. She could have been late teens.
Yeah, she got knocked up. They got married young. Mm-hmm. They lit her to make her look older. She verbally says, oh, I'm twice your age. But this is such a predictable, typical Hollywood crime to commit, to cast a woman who's far too young and a dude who's too old.
How old was he when they shot the movie?
He was 30, playing a 20, going on 21-year-old. Right. Yeah, he turns 21 in the movie.
Many other legendary actresses in Hollywood and around the world actually were in the running for it. I'm not going to go through the whole long list, but Judy Garland, Doris Day. I'm so glad she didn't get that. I don't like her.
That was Nichols' first choice, was Doris Day. She turned it down.
For the material and apparently the nudity, although she wouldn't have had to be nude anyway. And then I guess it's pronounced Jean Moreau. That would have been interesting. And the idea would have been a French actress, maybe with the accent, maybe she would have actually been French in the movie too, teaches the dumb young American the ways of love.
Well, it's hard to imagine anyone but Anne Bancroft in this role. She is the best thing in this film by a country mile. She's incredible.
Hoffman is great, but his character is hard to deal with and hard to understand, and so is Catherine Ross. Mrs. Robinson, for the most part, is consistent, unlike the other two, and yes, very well played. I also loved in the first scene we see her hairstyle, not that similar, but on the lines of The Bride of Frankenstein.
Okay.
She's got a little bit of a graying white thing on the sides.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Probably they were trying to age her. She's ruthless as a character. She ruthlessly uses manners, which I think is hilarious, to prey on Benjamin. He's so helpless against her polite requests for like a ride home, a chaperone, company, a friend to unzip her dress, to go fetch her purse. But she talks to him with that impatient scold of a mother and barely conceals her outrageous intentions. If the roles had been reversed and it was Mr. Robinson trying to seduce a young woman in that same way, it would be creepy and frightening, but it's hilarious because it's a woman.
It's still that same kind of story you hear now. If a young man gets with an older woman, most people will be kind of snickery about it, even if the legal definition and maybe even the logical definition is
statutory raped. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's still that stigma that if it's a young girl, she was not doing this of her own volition the way that a young man maybe would.
Yeah, her behavior is bordering on irredeemable. Actually, it probably is irredeemable.
These are crappy people.
In a reprehensible way. Still, that being said, with all the characters being who they are, that moment when she runs through the rain to get in Ben's car and beseech him to leave Elaine alone and she's soaking wet and that look in her eyes, from that moment on, my sympathies are 100% with her.
And my favorite part of that scene is when it's just after and he's running into Elaine's room to finally come clean before the mother does, to say, that woman, that older woman I was with, he never says who it actually is, but then she turns around and sees her mother standing there looking pathetic, like they both do, both Ben and Mrs. Robinson, soaked with the rain. They look like pathetic little rats. But the look on her face, and then that goodbye, Benjamin, another great shot that Nichols, I don't know if he conceived it, he would have worked with the cinematographer, but she says goodbye, Benjamin, the camera pulls back and he's 100 feet away from her. But when she says it, in reality, she would have been a foot or two away from him at the outside of the door.
Yeah, Nichols in this film over and over again plays with what's in the foreground and what's in the background. Yeah. You'll frequently see a relatively tight shot of Benjamin's face and people talking at him in front of him and crossing over the camera and kind of getting in the way of your line of vision. And the camera never turns around to see the person who's talking to him. It always stays on Benjamin, but those foreground elements are so bold. And it's partly because those are the influences in his life and they're overwhelming and they're filling the screen, right? And they're filling his head.
A lot of times with that Charlie Brown thing where you don't need to see the parents' faces or the grown-ups' faces.
Yeah, at the point where he's floating around in the pool and his mom and dad are swimming around him, they're like sharks.
Yeah, good
circling
point.
His flotation device.
And that's a very famous device in this movie. He goes underwater more than once in this movie to escape, I guess. How many times does he end up getting filmed underwater?
Well, he's actually filmed underwater. Oh, yeah, it's a few times, isn't it? Because he's swimming. I didn't count how many times.
Three.
Yeah.
Because it was such a strong motif and it's been homaged, especially by Wes Anderson in his various films.
He goes from being submerged, like he's drowning in the beginning
against
of the film.
Against his will.
There's the famous scuba scene where he's underwater and they're pushing him, forcing him underwater. But over and over, if you look for it, there's imagery all throughout the film, especially the fish tank behind him. Mm-hmm. Like he's underwater, until he starts his affair with Mrs. Robinson and then he's adrift. Then he starts being adrift on the water. And they even say aloud, "You're adrift."
They do say that, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, he says, actually, "What are you doing, Ben?" "Just drifting."
Yeah.
Obviously has multiple meanings. One more thing about the scuba tank scene. People love that scene so much, but we pointed out during the movie that he's on the other side of the door while the father has this big buildup. When they open the door, he's all the way across the room, actually. It's probably 20 feet away, fully dressed in the entire scuba outfit. There's no way you'd ever hear him. He can't hear them because they get that great Darth Vader shot. That great Darth Vader shot where it's...
Yeah.
when you just
and
hear
the You can
the
see them
breath.
Yelling at him, but you can't hear one thing they're saying. Yet, when his father's yelling at him through the door, he can apparently make him out perfectly.
And he sounds fine. You just can't make out that he's actually got
the mask on.
The mask on, yeah, sure. So, a minor point, but in a movie that's so well made, technically.
His parents are a little silly as characters, too. They're very much caricatures.
Definitely. William Daniels is his father. He was in St. Elsewhere for a long time, and I guess the best thing that I would ever know him for, apart from this movie, would be the voice of Kit on Knight Rider.
Oh, wow. What a credit.
And his mother, Elizabeth Wilson, was in Picnic, The Birds, and The Addams Family. There's a diverse group of movies. And she's the one that seems to be on the right track to figuring out that Ben is having an affair. Maybe she doesn't figure out this with her husband's partner's wife.
Yeah, she knows something's up.
And maybe the only other scene in the whole movie where he seems to really connect with anybody is when he's shaving and the mother comes in to talk to him. Because he does connect with Elaine, even says as much, I feel like I can be myself with you. And he sort of seems to be himself with his mother in that one shaving scene. Otherwise, no. The men definitely intimidate him, especially Murray Hamilton, who plays Mr. Robinson. He's in Jaws so famously as the mayor. Mm-hmm. He joins Richard Dreyfuss, who's got a tiny role in this movie. Richard Dreyfuss is in four AFI movies, if you want to count this one. And we will, because he's got a tiny role. But Gene Hackman moves Mr. Robinson first. Dustin Hoffman's old friend. And we recently covered a Gene Hackman movie when we did Bonnie and Clyde. They were friends long before either of these movies came out the same year. I didn't hear if Hackman was fired or what happened, but apparently the role was his initially.
I think they decided not to cast him just because he wasn't old enough to play the part, really. They wanted an older man who could intimidate 30-year-old Dustin Hoffman.
Isn't it funny when Mr. Robinson comes to Berkeley and confronts Ben? He doesn't hit him. Not that you always have to go to the level of punching when somebody's been screwing your wife. But he almost seems like he's more offended, more wounded, rather than furious. He isn't furious in that scene anyway.
No, he's hurt.
It's more like, how could you?
Yeah.
Because he feels like he knows this kid. He's been sleeping with my wife all this time.
So I like that he didn't just do the typical boring guy thing and punch him out. Instead, comes to him with those naked emotions. Mm-hmm. Makes it more effective.
Now, usually it's early in the podcast I mention these numbers. I want to do it right now before I forget to altogether, because these are critical numbers to mention and the popularity of this film. Rotten Tomatoes, 87% of critics. 45 gave it a fresh review, 7 rotten, which is more than we've been covering lately.
Yeah, that's a fair amount for a movie that's this highly ranked. Mm-hmm.
But 92% of audiences. That, of course, wavers a little bit when somebody writes a new review. In fact, I think it wavered from the last time I checked until I checked earlier before we sat down tonight. But here's the bigger number. 21st on Box Office Mojo's adjusted for inflation list of all-time hits. $2.5 million shy of $700 million adjusted for inflation.
Wow. This movie was a huge hit.
For a counterculture movie of that time, and that was obviously going to be a big thing, there isn't much pot, free love, hippies, the R&R culture, let's just sit back and relax. Well, okay, there's that, actually, because he's always just chilling out and doing nothing, drinking beer, floating around in the pool, but
yeah,
not the other things.
Sitting around his capitalist parents' mansion.
You said it on Bonnie and Clyde, that Easy Rider, there are hippies in that, but it's also, they're drug dealers actually, and only one of them looks like a hippie, and that's Dennis Hopper's character. But this movie doesn't really have any of that. There's a little bit we see here and there, but not a major part of the movie, and certainly not our characters.
Yeah, it's true. These counterculture movies of the 60s don't look like what we imagine the 60s counterculture to be. I don't believe any of these characters went to Woodstock.
Right. Well, last week's film, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, had a similar theme, by the way, another movie that was made in this era of things are changing. I think we agreed that was dated. I certainly feel like that movie's dated, despite its nice intentions.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So the same theme is that parents disapprove of their daughter's romantic choices. Both movies are also set in California, although that was in San Francisco, and this is in the heart of Los Angeles. I don't think too many people have actually compared those two films very often, but they can be compared that way.
Like, a defining feature of the 60s and that generation, the hippie culture, is that it was kids breaking away from their parents, really trying to do something different from their parents. You never really understand why Ben wants to rebel against his parents. They actually seem like pretty happy, successful people.
And they seem to love him.
They definitely seem like they're good parents who care about him. They may be annoying, sure.
Their house seems a lot more loving than the Robinson house does.
Oh, definitely. Way bigger problems than the Robinson house.
Not just because she cheats on her husband. And maybe she's done it before. We never find out. That's one of the things about this movie that's so fascinating. One of the better characters, maybe in the entire list so far, played so well by Anne Bancroft, written pretty well, but we don't learn much of anything about her, which I guess is true about Mrs. Iceland. We keep on mentioning her as well.
We just learned that she majored in art. Mm-hmm. I love that moment. It's such a great touch.
Yep. Yeah, and I love the way that Hoffman delivers that line. I guess you just lost interest in it over the years.
What a dope.
Trying to talk to her. There's one of those scenes I talked about before where the lights are turned off several times, but we hear them talking for big stretches of time. Now, there's no cut because you can tell there's just a little bit of light in the top right part of the screen. spilling in from the outside. So maybe they loop the dialogue, but the scene doesn't cut. But as far as Ben's malaise, I can actually relate to that even now. I'm twice the age that he's supposed to be in this movie. I'm not sure I know what I want to do even now.
Yeah, but you're not a sad sack about it.
Well, that's true. I don't think I ever was.
He's just so bummed. He's so indulgent about it. I sympathize with him wanting to ignore his annoying, pestering parents, but he doesn't seem to have any better ideas than they have.
He's actually kind of like Hamlet, because he doesn't know what he wants, he doesn't know how he's ever going to resolve his glum feelings, and then when he does, he ruins everything.
Yeah, this feeling that we have that Ben is wrong to be rebellious, that's what Nichols intended, because of the last scene, you know, when that culminates in that very cinematic and very typical Hollywood big ending where he interrupts the wedding and he gets Elaine and they get on the bus, and you're like, what? How wacky and fun, look at you, you're on a bus, and I think it's interesting, it's a bus. Not like his car, which broke down, because a bus, you can't just get off. You don't have agency over where the bus is going.
Right.
So they're stuck on this bus, wherever it's taking them, they may not even know. And the camera could just cut with them, their smiling faces while they're sitting there being stared at by all the other riders, but it doesn't. It stays on them for that extra awkward minute. That is Nichols' way of saying, they effed up, man. Yep. They should have just done what their parents said, or anything but what they did.
Yeah. And everyone knows that, even if they haven't seen the movie, because it's been homaged by many people, many TV shows, many other movies. The Simpsons have certainly done an homage at least once. But it is one of the ultimate so-now-what endings in film history. Like you say, they cut earlier, and maybe the whole scene changes. Apparently what Nichols was doing, when they were all laughing and clapping their hands, and again, the audio drops out. You vaguely sort of hear a little bit of their whooping and hollering, but not much. And in comes Simon and Garfunkel. We'll talk about the music in a minute. But what happened was Nichols was saying to them, as the scene's playing out, laugh! You gotta laugh! You gotta laugh! And what happens? I'm self-conscious now. And that's that whole thing where it plays out. And they're not laughing. It's kind of like the end of The Omen. Richard Donner talks in the commentary. At the end of that movie, the kid turns towards the camera, the very last shot of The Omen. And the kid's name is Harvey. And Donner said, don't you laugh, Harvey. Don't you smile. Don't you smile at all. Don't you laugh or do it. And then, of course, what does the kid do? But he smiles.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing with this. So it's a reverse psychology kind of thing. In this case, you want to manipulate actors very blatantly right to their face.
And it's an amazing moment. And he lets it play out for too long, but just long enough. That was a really unusual choice to make at the time for a Hollywood film. Yeah. And just like Bonnie and Clyde, he was heavily influenced by the French New Wave.
So you brought this up a minute ago. Do you think the filmmakers get how erratic and stupid this decision they've made is? Are the filmmakers aware of what we've been saying in this whole courtship that Ben and Elaine sort of have? The whole thing about, will you marry me tomorrow? Maybe. I don't know. Why are you even considering marrying this guy you don't really like in the first place? Who's banged your mother at the very least. Most people could never get past that, even if it was more innocent, even if he didn't know either of the Robinsons and just finds out. Another trope in movies we've seen so many times, you're sleeping with the person's mother or their sister, or they were married and you didn't know. This one, he knows blatantly what he's doing when he goes after the two different Robinson women. But that's my question for you. Do you think the filmmakers are well aware the whole time, or at least at this ending, look at these two idiots? Mike Nichols himself was not even 40 years old.
Well, at almost 40 years old, he's still closer to Mrs. Robinson's age than Benjamin's.
That's true.
But that being said, the book was written by Charles Webb, who wrote it when he had just graduated from college himself. So he was writing from Ben's perspective, whereas Nichols maybe sympathized with Mrs. Robinson a little more. And I do believe he thinks they're idiots for doing what they've done. That they've made a mistake. Maybe they're not idiots. They're idiots. But they are idiots. He thinks that they've made a mistake because they've made a mistake.
Well, for one thing, she is married to the other guy, to Carl.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess an annulment would take care of that toot sweet when a bride does that. I don't think that legally it's very hard to get out of a marriage like that. Oh, okay. And that marriage probably was going to be bad, too. There's definitely lots of hints in the film that that guy is not who she should be marrying either. You know, his frat brothers are kind of rude about her. There's an implication that that wouldn't have been a happy life for her either. So maybe she's best getting out of that marriage. But being with Ben, no way.
That'll never work.
No, she's basically walking away from her whole family at that point, which is a terrible idea. He's destroying his parents' business partner relationships with one another. And they don't belong together.
They really don't.
They don't even seem to like each other. It's just like they're doing it to get back at their parents for some reason. It's a bad decision. And I believe that Nichols knew that and that he's illustrating that. Seems perfectly obvious to me. He wants the audience to root for them, though. In that part of the film when Ben is chasing Elaine, I think he wanted and failed to get the audience to, well, not fail to get me to root for them. he wants the audience to root for them to fall in love, to end up together, because that's just so Hollywood. But then that reversal in the last moment is such a brilliant trick, because it's not just that commentary that they're being irrational, but it's also that commentary on the audience that irrationally wants them to be together even though they don't belong together.
And using religious iconography as well, when he puts the cross to pin everybody into the church, using it as a weapon first. Well, maybe we shouldn't be surprised America's messed up now. If the people of the generation that we're talking about, which is the baby boomers, inherited the world and then went and malaised it away so much of this time, so much of this era.
They all ended up in plastics, and now there's way too much plastic.
It's good advice, for sure, that guy gives him.
He should have ended up in plastics. I think it was Ebert who pointed out, of course he should be in plastics. That's excellent advice. He doesn't have a creative bone in his body. What is he going to do with his life?
He was a track star in college. I'd forgotten that detail. We know he runs in the movie. But I guess the idea being that he's already great at that, and he's also running in Marathon Man, which he did in the mid-70s.
Yeah, I thought of that in all of his running scenes. Hoffman's a fast runner.
And as I point out to you, Dustin Hoffman has never been the best-looking guy, but he probably looked as good in this movie as he ever did in any film, including his body.
I mean, he's cute. He's no Robert Redford, but he's hardly a troll. He can be winning.
But he, of course, is a Jewish guy, and he looks and sounds like he is. His parents, no one else in the movie actually looks like they're Jewish, but maybe that's kind of the point, too, is you cast somebody who doesn't belong. I'm going to mention this movie again, Manchurian Candidate, Lawrence Harvey's English accent creeping through just a little bit in that movie, which probably wasn't deliberate, but you cast a guy who doesn't fit with anybody else in that movie from that standpoint, because they're all Americans, and that sets him apart even more. And maybe that was one of the unintentional, or maybe even intentional choices to go with him, because obviously it would have been a long and big search to try to get the person for this film, and they end up going with somebody who was an unknown. So Mike Nichols, the director who searched so hard for the lead in this film, his second film after Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was about, what, 4 or 5 weeks ago? Only these two films for him, though. He's done. He did Working Girl and Closer and Wolf and so many other titles. Not that many that I personally think are all that great. He was 36 years old in this film, winning the Oscar. And he kept on working for a long time, although he's in semi-retirement. Maybe it's flat-out retirement now. He's not made a movie in quite a long time. The writers were Buck Henry, who was best known for Get Smart, which was with Mel Brooks. That name keeps coming up in this podcast. And Calder Willingham, who we talked about on Spartacus. He also had a hand in Paths of Glory, which probably should have made this list. And Webb's book, you talked about already. It was written in 1963, so 4 years apart. A little bigger gap, but we keep on seeing this, though, where they get these books and they turn them into blockbuster movies very quickly after. In some cases, they won all kinds of awards and acclaim, too. But getting back to Buck Henry for a second, he actually acted in his career, or still has been acting in his career, more than he's ever written. He has a cameo in this movie as the hotel desk clerk. Are you here for an affair, sir? What? The Singleman Party. The Singleman Party. One of my favorite exchanges in the whole film. It's pretty on the nose, double entendres, but the affair and then the singleman, single man, that whole thing.
Appropriate that a writer should get that line.
Yeah. And one of the few times when Ben is with Elaine where the movie's funny, when they end up in the Taft Hotel, which was actually the Ambassador Hotel where RFK was killed, and everyone recognizes him.
Yeah, Mr. Gladstone. Hello, Mr. Gladstone.
A little funny moment there. But one of the few when he's with Elaine. The producer is Lawrence Terman, who's best known for John Carpenter's The Thing, and the executive producer, Joseph Levine. So this film that everyone thinks of as an acting showcase, and that it is, but it's also, as we've been saying, a technical showcase. It was 2:25:1, so a widescreen kind of thing, Technicolor. The Blu-ray that we have looked pretty good, although, I gotta fix this, we couldn't hear the DTS track, because for some reason, sometimes the DTS track works on the Blu-ray player, and sometimes it doesn't. We just listen to the mono. Maybe we should anyway, that's where the movie was released.
You mentioned the widescreen, that was another new wave influence. It's got the jittery cuts, the odd camera angles, and like we already said, that ambiguous and unsettling ending. The widescreen was also a French New Wave influence.
And we've been seeing more small, stripped-down movies lately, actually. This one's pretty cinematic in comparison to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, for example, and some of the other ones we've seen lately. The cinematographer shooting this film, Robert Surtees, who won 3 Oscars and did Ben-Hur quite a while ago on the project. He still has The Last Picture Show. What a diverse threesome that is. And also shot The Sting, which didn't make the list. Another movie that's pretty well-revered. The editor, Sam Osteen, we talked about him on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and we will talk about him on Chinatown. He often worked with Nichols. In fact, he generally worked with Nichols. We talked about the great cuts in this movie and the way they're set up, and a big part of that is the director. Of course, it's how you shoot the scene, how you prepare it. It isn't just a technical person cutting it. You know this as an editor.
Oh, yeah, and like you already said, there's tons of long takes. There's no work for the editor to do when the entire scene takes place in one take.
Yeah, and they also tell the story in montage and through music so much of the time. Some of the great cuts in this movie would be when he's diving onto his raft, and then the cut is that he's diving onto Mrs. Robinson, presumably after they've just had an orgasm together. I bet even their orgasms are both malaise and boredom. Him malaise, her boredom.
I know, when you think about it, could you even imagine that sex being any good?
Well, it must be something. They keep on going back to it.
I guess so.
And not exactly a cheap hotel. I just said music a minute ago. So, the composer, I didn't know there actually was a composer in this film, but then the opening credits does have Dave Grusin's name mentioned. I think he just did a little bit of arranging and that kind of stuff.
It was additional music by, I think, is the credit they gave him.
But really what it came down to is Simon and Garfunkel's songs were used as the score. Now, Mrs. Robinson, one of the most famous songs in the history of movies, when you finally hear the lyrics, because you hear it instrumentally many times in the movie, when you finally hear the lyrics when he's going after Elaine on the wedding day, I don't think that the lyrics make sense with that point in the movie. Maybe early on it would have made sense. And again, maybe Nichols knows that. But maybe
No, I'll tell you what happened.
Okay.
So they had initially used the Simon and Garfunkel songs just as a stand-in for pacing. They were just songs that they liked, and it was kind of roughly the idea of what they wanted in the final film. So editors do this all the time. When they know music's going to be composed, they pick something like what they want the film to sound like. They pick these Simon and Garfunkel songs, but then Nichols decided he liked them so much that he insisted on using them in the final cut. And they contacted Paul Simon and asked him to write a song for the movie. Well, he happened to be on tour at the time and never got around to it. He just never found time or inspiration or whatever. And they're trying to insist that he has to give them a song. He goes, I only have this one song called Mrs. Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And they were just like, okay, we don't care. We'll take it as it is. Change Mrs. Roosevelt to Mrs. Robinson. And that's why he said it was a song about days past.
Right.
You know,
where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio?
Yeah, it's about the past, which in the case of Ben, you're right. It's completely inappropriate. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense. Not like Sound of Silence, where that song is used only to kind of illustrate how sad he is and how he's so lonely.
And you point out when he's going to Berkeley to find her, and he's just told his parents, I'm going to marry Elaine, which of course could be a horror movie moment. It's like, here's where the stalking begins. But that song doesn't make sense. Sound of Silence should not be played in that moment.
It's Scarborough Fair at that point.
Okay, well, that song should not be played in that moment.
Absolutely, it's almost worse. But Scarborough Fair, at least the lyrics kind of make sense. Scarborough Fair is about a man who's trying to win back a girl, and she doesn't want him, so she keeps giving him insurmountable, impossible tasks to achieve. Mm-hmm. It's an old English folk song. Okay. It's such a strange standout song in that moment. Whatever reason they decided to use it in that moment, it just didn't work for me. I was not feeling it.
And yet this movie is so revered for its music. And also a comparison to a movie we're going to do very soon, 2001 A Space Odyssey, same idea where there was going to be a traditional score and the director, when they're cutting it, found this other music and ended up using it for the final cut. Alex North's score in that movie wasn't used, and they went with the classical music instead.
In my opinion, too much better effect.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Even though I love those songs, don't get me wrong, I love Simon and Garfunkel. I think Paul Simon is one of the greatest songwriters that America has ever produced. In this case,
they don't fit.
And the way they just use Sound of Silence over and over and over again, too.
You want to pull away and say, but you guys are wrong, we think, anyway. Before we get into the influence, the other technical person I want to mention, Richard Silbert, because he has now done 3 of the 4 AFI films. This guy's a legendary set designer. Did The Manchurian Candidate, we talked about it so much. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And he'll be the set guy on Chinatown. All right, so the influence. Epic amount of influence. First of all, the music, getting back to that. Not using a traditional orchestral score. Lucas on American Graffiti did the same thing, where he used pop music that already existed. All the songs were from the 60s.
Yeah, that's a good point. It was pretty unusual to use songs in this way in the film.
And
to just use pre-existing songs.
And 2001 not using a traditional score. And then the songs themselves being such huge hits. We've seen movies that have had their song be a big hit in the soundtrack. The old-fashioned records people would buy and help make it a huge hit. I think West Side Story and Sound of Music both, you could say that about. And this one just as much, if not more so. Young people being front row center in the story. We haven't really seen that much before. You said it on Rebel Without a Cause way back when for us that was maybe the first time that it happened in the project. I guess it was probably the first time.
Yeah, West Side Story would be another great example. Mm-hmm.
If there's been anything else, certainly not as the main thrust, but in this movie, definitely that is the case.
Speaking of both those movies, and we talked about casting a little bit earlier, Natalie Wood was in both those films, and she was offered the role of Mrs. Robinson and Elaine Robinson.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess that says a lot about her acting ability. They thought she could play either one of them. By the way, did they ever actually speak to each other on camera?
Elaine and Mrs. Robinson? Yeah. Not in my memory.
They share. No. Oh, they do. The end of the movie when he busts her out of the wedding. She says, it's too late, Elaine. Not for me.
That's their only exchange.
I think it is, yeah.
Well, you know, another big gap in the story of Elaine Robinson and why she does anything in this movie. Her relationship with her parents is.
Yeah, Hoffman is in, I think, every single scene in this movie. Certainly, almost all the scenes. The other two aren't as much. As you said, it's first is Mrs. Robinson the first half, Elaine in the second half. Other characters flit in here and there, but we really don't see anybody interact with anybody else apart from involving Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, more influence. The Broadway show in 2002 with Kathleen Turner
playing
Mrs. Robinson and Jason Biggs. Interesting choice. Playing Benjamin Braddock. There was an unofficial sequel that Rob Reiner directed. It's more of an offshoot, but it was called Rumor Has It. And I saw it way back when I saw movies all the time in the theater. Kevin Costner's in it, Jennifer Aniston's in it.
I forgot all about that
And the
movie.
Idea is that it's based on who they based the Ben character on, and that's Costner's grown-up version of him.
Right, that's right.
I mentioned already Wes Anderson. Well, Rushmore, for one thing, number of times the characters go in water in a Wes Anderson movie, and certainly in Rushmore, which is to get away from everybody, leave me the hell alone. Plus, just the whole storyline is kind of similar in some way. The difference is it's a current student versus somebody who just graduated.
And he's pursuing the older woman while the younger woman is pursuing him rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. And even though I'm not a fan of Jason Schwartzman, he's way more root forable.
Yeah, Max is just kind of a sweeter character with better intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Young and foolish, yes. But, yeah, more root forable.
Mm-hmm. And the very last influence I want to mention would be something that you point out. Jackie Brown, and I'm sure this is deliberate on Tarantino's part, because I actually looked on YouTube to compare, and they're very comparable, the opening, where Ben is on one of those conveyor things in the airport
that
he pulled along
movers.
During the opening credits, mm-hmm. the people mover, yeah. And then Jackie in the opening of that movie with Across 110th Street playing as she's being pulled along during the credits.
And like you pointed out when we saw it, he's going from right to left, which is mm-hmm. the opposite of how we would naturally read a scene, which
backwards.
Is right to left. It's the filmmaker's way of saying that he's going against the grain.
Mm-hmm. And also, somebody else pointed this out on the internet, and I never knew what shot they were talking about. Now I think I do. That he's running somewhere but not getting anywhere. It must be the scene towards the end with the wedding where he's trying to stop it, and it's a long lens.
Yeah.
And he's just gotten out of his car and he's running towards it. And it's a long shot, and I guess that's the idea. That he's running and running and running, but he's really not getting anywhere until towards the end of the shot. Then yes, he does come close up to us.
That's a good point.
All right, the long AFI and awards list. This will take a bit of time to get through. Well, we've talked about it plenty, so the one Oscar was for Mike Nichols' direction. The six nominations, Best Picture, Best Actor for Hoffman, Best Actress for Bancroft, Supporting Actress for Catherine Ross, the screenplay by Henry and Willingham, and the cinematography by Surtees. The movie took 7 years, but it is on the National Film Registry. It made it in 1996. And then here's this impressive list. It's 52nd on the top 100 passions. Could have been maybe even higher, considering this guy is banging one woman and wants to get with another one. There are two lines in the top 100 quotes list. You're probably going to know what these are. Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me, aren't you? The key part of that whole scene. No one really wants to quote that, aren't you? But that's the best part of that entire thing.
Yeah.
She laughs at him and then it's, wait, am I wrong? That was 63rd on the top 100 quotes list. And plastics, just the one line, is 42nd. I think by far the better quote, the more meaningful quote, would be Mrs. Robinson trying to seduce me. And they both maybe could have been higher considering how much they were quoted by other people. The last two mentions, 9th on the top 100 laughs. And considering this movie is half of a funny movie, that's pretty highly praised. But then if you're going to say it's 7th on the main list, and the comedy list came out between the first and the second AFI top 100s, the main ones, how is it not 3rd or 4th or something like that?
Yeah, it's a good point. There's a few dubious things. I guess on comedy's list, then they would have let how funny it was trump the decision of where it belonged on the list.
I guess it must be something to do with that.
I guess.
And it was 6th on the top 100 songs with Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah, I love the song, but like you pointed out, it's inappropriate lyrically for that point in the film.
Yeah.
It's just a good song.
And highly influential. So what are your last thoughts about The Graduate?
In conclusion, a great film that is perhaps not aging so well.
You didn't use air quotes there, but you could have.
Well, it's far from one of my favorites.
Would you put it on the list if you had a vote?
I would put it on the list, but it would not be in the top 10 or 25.
It does suit the criteria, for the most part. The influence, we've talked about that plenty. The fact it was a giant success and people still like it even to this day. Young people are going to see this movie and probably relate to it the way that they did in 1967. And it did win some awards. It only won Oscar, but it won other types of awards. And it certainly was rewarded in that community. So it fits all those criteria. Other AFI lists, I just talked about all those. But yeah, still, there's just something that doesn't really completely make sense.
I will take issue with you saying young people will relate to it. The first time I saw it, I was 19 or 20 years old. I was Ben's age, and I found it far more confounding then than I do now.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're watching it through the eyes of Mrs. Robinson?
No, I think I probably would have related to Ben far more at that point in my life.
But now, I'm saying.
Oh, yes. Now I could probably understand her more, and her character is so interesting and fun and cool that she probably makes the film better for me. And it's really fun to just sink your teeth into each scene and see the prowess of Nichols as a director of individual scenes, maybe not the entire film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I've never been a big fan of this movie compared to what most people feel about it. And Seventh, when I first saw that show in 98, I was confounded by that. Mm. Thought for sure it was going to drop a lot further than 17th, but at least it isn't in the top 10 anymore.
Once baby boomers aren't the voting members anymore, I bet we'll see this film plummet in its AFI listing. Even on Rotten Tomatoes, it does not do as well as it should if it was ranked by the AFI.
True. All right, so before we end the podcast, we've ended a year, 1967. We had four movies, not the biggest year, but one of the biggest years, In the Heat of the Night, Bonnie and Clyde, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and The Graduate. So what is your favorite of those four?
Bonnie and Clyde, easy no contest. Choice. It is the best film of those four, without question.
You said it was in your top 10 if you had to make a list right now. Yeah,
and I really liked In the Heat of the Night a lot, but Bonnie and Clyde is a masterpiece.
Now, we wouldn't put Guess Who's Coming to Dinner on the list, period, if we had a vote. We agreed on that.
Yeah.
We agree Bonnie and Clyde should be highly ranked, and it is. In The Heat of the Night, I don't know if I'd put on the list, you would. And we're saying The Graduate belongs, maybe not quite as high as it should be. So would it be, if you had to rank them all, let's say we had to include Guess Who's. I guess we're going to go Bonnie, In the Heat, Graduate, Guess Who's.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I'll say this, as much as I would say, empirically, The Graduate is a better film and a more important film to film buffs.
Yeah.
If you were to ask me, which film would you rather sit down and watch right now between that and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? I think I might pick Guess Who's Coming to Dinner just because I enjoyed the experience of watching that film more than The Graduate.
I think that's a very compelling argument you've just made about this movie that people revere, but is it really something you want to see again? This was an epic title, as we said, and Bonnie and Clyde only a few weeks ago was one of the other huge ones we've had. And we are going to get in the 70s very soon when they seem to be huge every single week. But we're not quite there yet. Nor are we yet in the 80s, but we're going to be doing a 1980s film next week because we're taking our seventh break from the March of Top 100 films to review a picture that wasn't on AFI's list. Just before Halloween, our seventh Top 100 project choice will be the haunted hotel flick with Jack Nicholson going nuts and Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
I've been campaigning for this one for a while because it is one of my all-time favorite films. I love this one.
Your campaign was apparently not to me because you didn't have to convince me too hard.
No.
We were just talking about should it be one of the end of the year choices, you know, set it in winter and that kind of thing right before the new year, or do we use it as our horror film choice? Last year we used Night of the Living Dead. There weren't a lot of horror films that aren't on the list that we agreed on would make good choices. I would love to have done The Exorcist. Rosemary's Baby I thought you were into more than you are. Halloween, but you're not a fan of that one at all. This one was an easy one to agree on. We easily agreed on this one. Shining is one of the legendary ones. And interestingly, we're going to do two Kubricks in a row.
Yes.
Now, we can pick whatever movies we want to. We want to do this specifically for Scary Movie Week. And we talked about that for about 7 seconds and thought, should we do that back to back? Well, it's our project and we can pick whatever movies we want to. So, yes.
If you don't want two Kubrick movies in a row, too bad. Listen to another podcast. Oh, don't listen to another podcast. Listen to us. Please just listen to us. We're sorry.
Did you come back? Anybody who cares about classic movies are not going to argue with us doing two Kubricks in a row because they must be fans of him. That's our schedule next little while, by the way. Shining next, 2001, and then we get to 1969, four movies in a row there, starting with the Best Picture winner of that year, Midnight Cowboy. All right, so the coming attractions trivia for next week's film, The Shining. How many Stanley Kubrick films are in the top 100 of this, the IMDb's, the Internet Movie Database's, top 250? Not hard to find, but there you go.
Very good question. Okay, so for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast for The Shining, our Halloween spectacular. For more trivia and lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, including links to some of the things we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us at Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What do you think of The Graduate? Are we idiots who just don't get it?
Grant will think so.
Oh no, Grant, I'm sorry. Please let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, we would like to warmly thank our sponsors, Sparkplug Coffee.
Let me out.
And cut.